Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
Are California's freeway bridges safe enough? Hello again, I'm Orman Alney, and this is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. Southern California has more heavily traveled highway bridges than any place else in the country. Nobody says they're in danger of falling down, but many are in serious need of repair. And Caltrans has fired an inspector for falsifying documents on bridge safety. We'll hear two reports. Also tonight, illegal immigration from Mexico is on the decline, and some Mexican families who came north for a better life are going home, despite the widespread violence south of the border. Later on, what's the future of Occupy Wall Street? First, here's the news. Warman Alney back with Which Way LA on KCRW. Demonstrators were evicted this morning from Zuccotti Park, but New York isn't the only city where Occupy Wall Street has clashed with local officials. We'll hear what's happening in other places and ask if the movement has a chance to make political change. That's later on our program. First, investigative reporting by the Sacramento Bee has raised questions about the safety of bridges in California. One safety inspector has been fired for falsifying records, including those for an underpass on the 405 freeway in Culver City. More on that in a moment. The story begins with the new eastern span of the San Francisco Bay Bridge, which is still under construction, biggest construction project in California history. Charles Piller is the Bee reporter who broke the story. Charles, thanks a lot for being on our program.
My pleasure.
Tell us what was falsified. What was the nature of these records?
Well, these are testing records of the structural soundness of the deep foundations of freeway structures. These are the steel and concrete supports that underpin bridges, freeway overpasses, large road signs, and the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge, among, you know, thousands of other structures in the state. The problem involves a particular technician by the name of Dwayne Wiles, who was found to have falsified, at least on three occasions, data associated with the testing of the concrete of these deep foundations. The importance of that, of course, is that the stability of the structure depends on an accurate knowledge of the density of that concrete. So that is the fundamental beginning of the problem. The bigger problem involves the way in which Caltrans managed both its investigation of these falsified readings and its general management of the testing program associated with deep foundations of freeway structures. So the answer to those two important questions are that it did only an extremely cursory and inadequate investigation of possible falsified data on other structures across the state. Consequently, in the words of the engineers within Caltrans who were charged with doing that examination, the results are completely unreliable. They just simply don't know how extensive this problem might have been because the very hard forensic work associated with finding those results has not yet been done. So that's key. That's key, is that there needs to be more work done. Now, Caltrans reassures us that they have done an adequate examination and that all the structures around the state are safe. There's only one small problem. They refuse to release any information associated with what evaluation they did, what research they did. All I'm asking is they should let the public take a look at that to understand better the reassurances and whether they are indeed credible reassurances.
We asked Caltrans repeatedly to come on tonight's program, but so far we haven't heard back. In the meantime, here's Malcolm Dougherty, the acting director, at a press conference yesterday.
There's been a lot of conversation about the Bay Bridge. The individual worked on the Bay Bridge project before the issues were raised and discovered on the falsification of testing. We did go back and review all the foundation testing that was done by all the technicians on the self-anchored suspension section, the tower and its foundation, and did not find any evidence of any falsification of data on those tests.
So, Charles Piller, back to you. What you're saying is that they didn't investigate hard enough, weren't able to find a lot of the records, and so can't really be as firm as we just heard.
Well, it's perplexing. Their responses have been all over the map, so to speak. For example, you heard in that clip that the Caltrans officials believe they have done an adequate investigation. On the other hand, news reports have stated that they are planning to have their peer review committee of seismic experts reevaluate the entire design and testing data associated with those deep foundations for the bridge. If they're so confident, why are they having it reevaluated? We think that reevaluation is a good idea. We just don't really buy the basis for their complete confidence. Not because we say that those data have been falsified, because we don't have evidence of that for the Bay Bridge. But what we do know is that the management of this operation, the so-called foundation testing branch of California's Department of Transportation, they had such loose management over their own operations that they had a situation where not only was one technician falsifying information on tests, but also they didn't save the raw data files that are essential to knowing with certainty that no other tests were falsified. These are the data that are created by the test instrument and are unalterable by technicians. The problem occurred when the technician altered text data files that were generated by these raw data files created by the testing device. That's a technical point, but a very important one, because it means that they routinely discarded the very evidence they need to reassure the public that there aren't any further problems. What we're asking and what we're hoping is that Caltrans will reveal the precise nature of their supposed investigation. Since they haven't revealed any information about what investigation was done, all we have to go with is the voluminous documentation that I have, which is Caltrans documentation from its own files that contradicts virtually everything they've said.
So essentially then, you're reporting that it's not clear, and Caltrans hasn't made clear, that the bridge itself, $6.3 billion project, biggest in the history of the state, is safe.
I think there are questions that have arisen about it. I think qualified experts who have reviewed hundreds of engineering diagrams and test results and test reports provided by me that are the official Caltrans documents associated with that bridge ask the question, it would be useful, they say, to take a look at this fresh, to assume some of the uncertainties that are introduced by having a technician who's a known fabricator be the key technician in testing these piles. I'm not saying that the bridge is fatally flawed. I'm not saying it's going to fall down, nor are any of these experts. They're merely saying extreme irregularities took place with regard to the testing of this structure and many others around the state. Why not have qualified experts look at the information, come to an assessment, and reassure the public, if they can, of the safety of the structure?
Okay. Let me just ask you to stay long enough to review this. There are three structures in Southern California where data was falsified. They are a retaining wall at the Braddock Drive underpass of the 405 freeway in Culver City, a carpool connector lane between the 57 and the Pomona Freeway near Diamond Bar, and a ramp on the Riverside Freeway at La Sierra Avenue in Riverside. Once again, here is the acting director of Caltrans, Malcolm Daugherty.
We've gone back and evaluated each of those structures. One of them was discovered during construction, so we addressed that one as we had the opportunity. The other two were gone back and evaluated to ensure that they were safe, and they have been deemed safe and adequate. Beyond that, the individual has been, from a personnel issue, does not work for us anymore, so we've addressed that issue as well.
Okay, referring there to Dwayne Wiles. Charles Piller, do the same questions exist about these installations?
Well, the La Sierra example, that one, so far as I understand, was indeed caught during construction, so it was able to be reevaluated and, if necessary, fixed before it was produced. That way, I don't think there's any concern about that I'm aware of. The other structures are a different story. It's not that that I necessarily think that those are unsafe structures. The problem is that it's typical of the way Caltrans has handled most of this. They assert that the structures are safe without providing any detailed information to show what analysis they reached, how they evaluated those structures, and how they can have a strong basis for reassuring the public. On the contrary, their own internal documents, memos written by their own officials involved in the testing of these structures, raised public safety concerns that they have not adequately refuted with their own further analyses. We're just asking for them to release information that could justify that optimistic claim.
Okay, a lot of things we don't know, but you're not saying either, neither is anybody else, I take it, that these things are likely to fall down.
We're looking at unknowns here, and it's very important for more information to be released publicly. That's really the heart of the matter.
Charles Piller, investigative reporter for the Sacramento Bee. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you.
Southern California has 91 of the 100 most heavily traveled bridges in the United States, and of the top 10, almost all are on Interstate 10 in Los Angeles. Ryan Wiggins is Southern California organizer for Transportation for America, which advocates reform of federal transportation policy. Good to have you on our program.
Yes, thank you. Glad to be here.
How concerned should drivers be who are passing over these things or under them, in the case of the underpasses, given this information?
So according to data reported to the Federal Highway Administration by Caltrans, these bridges are rated as structurally deficient, and they rate three different portions of the bridges. There's the deck, which you drive across of, the supporting columns, the superstructure, and then the substructure, which is what's underneath the ground. If a bridge is structurally deficient, if it rates a 4 out of 9 on any of those, being structurally deficient doesn't mean that the bridge is going to fall down. What it means is it's classified as the federal government as needing significant repair or work done on it to resolve those issues. Most of the bridges on the 10 that you're referring to were built between the years of 1959 and 1962. What this means is that most bridges are generally designed for a 50-year life cycle. As they get older, they require more consistent maintenance. So these bridges, some of which are, there's about 300,000 cars daily going across them, you know, they have a significant amount of traffic. We can actually put a lot of strain upon them. So at this point, it's just incredibly critical to keep on maintaining them to make sure that they can continue to hold this amount of traffic.
Okay, just want to make the point. This is a different situation from the one we described with regard to the safety inspector who falsified documents. Not the same thing at all. And this is a federal judgment that these are structurally deficient. These are federal interstate highways, and the federal government pays for a lot of that maintenance. But is it paying enough to provide the maintenance on these structurally deficient structures that you're talking about?
No. Right now, we estimate that there's about 70,000 bridges nationwide that are classified as structurally deficient, and that would require about $71 billion to go ahead and bring them all up to a state of good repair. What the federal government is currently providing is around $5.2 billion per year. Is obviously just not enough. You know, you consider $71 billion this year is what it's estimated to repair those bridges. 3 years ago, it was 33% less. So we're talking about $47 million. So it's a significant jump over these years. And so as we go forward, we actually need the federal government to go ahead and put in that investment amount. That's one issue. The other issue is how states are required to actually use those dollars.
And not all states use all the money for the appropriate purposes, but California, you say, does.
That's correct. California received in 2009 about $500 million dedicated for bridge repair. It used all that money, and it also used $400 million in federal taxpayer dollars from other purposes, transportation purposes, to do the same thing. So they're actually doing their due diligence. They're using the money that's designated to do that. But you consider the amount of traffic we have in Los Angeles and the state as a whole, we can expect to absorb a population growth of several more million people over the ensuing years. We also expect trade to double in the next decade or so, which means there's going to be a lot more cars and trucks going over these bridges.
So you say these bridges are designed for 50 years. They need maintenance, but we don't need to worry about them falling down yet. When will we have to worry about them falling down?
It's basically going to be a combination of increasing traffic and not enough maintenance. So what you will get is at some point They might inspect these bridges, and they will take a look at them and see that there is a major repair needed in either the deck, the superstructure, or the substructure, and they will either have to restrict traffic going over those, or they will have to shut down the bridge entirely. And if you think about what we went through with Carmageddon in Los Angeles just a couple months ago, for the closure of one bridge, if we have partial closures or total closures to either repair or replace bridges, it's going to be pretty significant. And one other thing to understand that's incredibly critical is that replacing a bridge is way more expensive than actually maintaining it. So if we are willing to invest those dollars up front and hold our states accountable for using them in the correct way, then we can make sure and extend the life of these bridges by decades, and it will be save all of us money.
Ryan Wiggins with Transportation for America. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you as well.
We'll be right back with Which Way LA.
For more information about Which Way LA or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/whichwayLA. CD copies are also available. Call 1-800-600-KCRW.
Warman Olney back with Which Way LA. Data from both sides of the border suggest that illegal immigration from Mexico is already in fast retreat. We'll have more on that in a moment. First, here's the story of a Mexican family that moved to Santa Ana hoping for a better life. That was 15 years ago. Now they have moved back to Mexico. Cindy Carcamo is telling their story in the Orange County Register. And Cindy Carcamo, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you.
You describe a horrific situation in Acapulco. These people thought they were going back to a very different place from the one where they arrived. Tell us a bit about what they found.
Well, I think Alex Castro, the father and the family, probably said it best. This is not the Mexico that I left 15 years ago. They've basically found a changed Mexico. Although the girls had never been to Mexico, they went back to a place that's dramatically different. It's in the middle of a basic drug war right now. And not only are, you know, as a family, the three girls are teenage girls, not only do they have to deal with normal adolescent angst, but they also have to contend with an unusual set of circumstances. For instance, they're in the middle, you know, obviously of this drug war that's led to a sort of lawlessness in Acapulco. And they've become the victims of extortion, carjacking. And the worst for the family was when one of the girls, Grace, her friend and schoolmate, was killed after he was kidnapped from their private school. Her friend was a boy, and he was, his eyes were gouged out before he was kidnapped.
The parents are both illegal. The girls are American citizens. You say they have never been to Mexico?
Yes, actually, the girls had never. I'm sure that, you know, they'd heard about it. They're bilingual because they're in a dual immersion, you know, bilingual schools. But they had never been to Mexico. You know, these are teenage girls, very Americanized, and had to go to a place that they'd never been to. Two of the girls, the youngest, are U.S. born citizens. The eldest, Michelle, she was brought to the U.S. When she was 1 year old,
okay.
And so she has no legal status, and the parents have no legal status in the U.S.
What caused them to move from Santa Ana back to Acapulco, putting themselves and their girls at risk?
Well, basically, it's a combination of factors that led to their move to Mexico. First, primarily, it was the economy, especially after the father, Alex, lost his job. And in addition to that, there's, as you might know, there's been a growing anti-illegal immigration sentiment that's been manifesting itself in news broadcasts, and also with the sweeping anti-illegal immigration laws throughout the country. And there was talk not too long ago about doing away with birthright citizenship in the U.S., and that really scared the family. And the family worried that their older daughter, Michelle, that didn't have much of a didn't have much of a future, even after all her schooling, because she had no legal status. But probably what the last straw for the family was when the grandmother became ill with cancer, and so they thought, well, you know, we have all these troubles in the United States, and now our grandmother is ill with cancer, we should go back to Mexico, although the girls were very much opposed to the idea.
I think it's very important to point out that you say they began, the parents, losing hope that they could ever become U.S. citizens. Were they trying to do that?
Yes, actually, Alex Castro is he's a graphics designer, and he was a few units shy of graduating from the university in Guadalajara, and so he was really skilled, and he had actually gotten work illegally. You know, he was using fraudulent documents, and there was a whole shame issue to it. He didn't want to tell his employer that he was here illegally. Obviously, that would, you know, you never know what the employer would do. By the time he gained enough trust with his employers, because he had multiple employers, it was too late. Immigration laws had changed so dramatically, especially after September 11th, that there really wasn't any kind of remedy for him in his situation, being in the country illegally.
All right. Cindy Carcamo, immigration reporter for the Orange County Register. Now to that broader picture showing that illegal immigration is on the decline, Ken Ellingwood reports from Mexico City for the Los Angeles Times. And, Ken, it's always good to have you on our program.
Nice to be here, Warren.
Tell us in what ways illegal immigration is known to be declining. What are the measures?
Well, there are a couple of different measures. The Mexican government does a census and various kinds of surveys having to do with occupations and employment patterns. And they talk to people about, you know, where they live now and where they used to live. There are also statistics from the U.S. side of the border, from the Border Patrol, that is, how many people are they arresting on the border who are trying to get across into the United States. The Border Patrol statistics have been used for many years as a kind of a rough gauge of how many people are trying to cross illegally. Both sources of data show that the number of people migrating without papers from Mexico to the United States has been dropping dramatically, particularly during the past 4 years.
What about the story we just heard about the people moving from Santa Ana back to Acapulco? Do you hear that kind of story often?
Well, the one word that Cindy mentioned when she was describing the motives of the family was the economy. What you hear time and again here among migrants and experts who study migration is the economy. The U.S. economy has been so slow in recent years, producing so few jobs, particularly those low-end jobs that migrants have always occupied, on the U.S. side of the border, that slowdown has basically dried up the supply of jobs on the U.S. side. And Mexicans who are living on the U.S. side are telling their relatives and friends who are south of the border, don't bother coming. There's no work here.
Cindy Carcamo, back to you. What about Santa Ana, the city we talked about, whether we just discussed one a family? But is this going home actually a measurable phenomenon there, or does it just involve a few people?
Well, you know, basically, Guerrero State has long been tethered to Santa Ana. And now immigration, and mostly illegal immigration, like my colleague there pointed out, has dramatically decreased, according to analysts who study the issue. But also in my reporting, I found that there's been a reversal, although many analysts have said that it's very difficult to determine the number of immigrants leaving the United States for their Mexican homeland. Anecdotal information suggests to me, at least, that legal immigrants and those who are in the country legally are returning, and many of them are returning to get out of state. And that's having a real effect in Santa Ana. The school district numbers show there's been a 10% drop in enrollment. Our real estate agents have told me that a good portion of the foreclosures in the city are due to people returning to Mexico. And an influential Spanish-speaking church in the city, Templo Calvario, has seen an 15% drop. 15% of their parishioners leave the country, mostly for Mexico.
Ken Ellingwood, is there data on the returning to Mexico?
Yeah, there are data on the returning to Mexico, and Cindy's right. People are coming back. They're discouraged by the job market. They're discouraged by what they view as a hostile political environment that's embodied in these anti-illegal immigrant laws that some states have tried to pass, and they also have been affected by the increased enforcement along the border, so that the flow that used to be cyclical and circular doesn't look that way so much anymore. People are not making the back and forth trips every year. So some who are coming back to Mexico because they're discouraged by jobs are staying put here, or not going back. There still are a lot of people, I think it should be mentioned, there still are a lot of people who remain kind of trapped on the U.S. side because of the increased border enforcement that makes it so difficult to go back and forth. Those who still have jobs on the U.S. side, who don't have papers and who are living illegally on the U.S. side, have stopped going back and forth and are simply staying put on the U.S. side, which is somewhat a paradoxical result of increased border enforcement, is that you now have people who are illegal, but they are encouraged to stay on the U.S. side.
Okay. Obviously, things are changing with a lot of pain on both sides of the border. Ken Ellingwood, a correspondent in Mexico City for the Los Angeles Times. Cindy Carcamo, immigration reporter for the Orange County Register. Thanks to you both.
Thank you so much.
You can join the conversation on our Which Way LA Facebook page. In a moment, what's the future of Occupy Wall Street on Which Way LA? Warman Ali back with Which Way LA on KCRW. After hundreds of police forced protesters out of Zuccotti Park early this morning, lawyers for Occupy Wall Street went to court. Mayor Bloomberg had said it was his decision, and later today a judge upheld the ban on overnight camping. Before that decision came down, we talked with Justin Elliott, who's been covering the encampment for Salon.com. Justin, thanks for joining us again.
Good to be here.
How many protesters are there?
Well, overnight, I believe there were about 200 or 300 who were actually sleeping there, and they were the ones who were either arrested or left when the riot police came in. But the crowd, I arrived there about 8 a.m. Eastern time this morning, and the crowd has been swelling throughout the day. It is a weekday, of course. I mean, usually the crowd gets bigger there on the weekends, but I'd say there's at least 500 or 600 people there, demonstrators.
Are there more protests planned?
A lot of people I talked to are actually looking ahead to Thursday morning, which is when there was a pre-scheduled demonstration planned outside the New York Stock Exchange on Wall Street very early, about 7 a.m. I think the plan is to try to shut it down or at least disrupt the operations of the stock exchange in the morning. And now that a lot of people are hoping that the demonstration on Thursday morning is going to be really big.
Bloomberg said that the reason for the eviction was his concern and that of the private company that owns the park, that there were health and safety problems. Did they make a good case?
It's hard for me to say. I mean, Bloomberg has been saying citing health and safety problems from the beginning. I mean, I would note that there was some violence last night. I mean, it's sort of ironic they're invoking health and safety, and there was some pretty violent tactics used by police last night. There is some video going around over the evictions last night, although not as much as you would think, partly because the NYPD actually barred a bunch of reporters from going to the scene. There was barricades put up about a two-block perimeter around the park. So there weren't as many journalists there as you might have expected. I mean, in terms of whether Bloomberg made a good case, I mean, I guess We'll have to see what the polls say. I mean, New Yorkers, in the polls that I've seen, New Yorkers have generally supported the presence of the protesters in the park. Then again, they have been hammered for the last couple of weeks by a lot of negative press, especially from the tabloids here in the city. You know, the Rupert Murdoch-owned New York Post has been running cover story after cover story talking about crime in the park and drunks and so on. So there has been some public relations problems.
Well, Justin Elliott again with Salon.com. Thanks very much for being on our program. Around the country, city officials are trying to decide what to do about protests related to Occupy Wall Street. In Oakland, California, there was a violent confrontation with police 3 weeks ago. Yesterday, the Frank Ogawa Plaza was peacefully evacuated. Oakland Mayor Gene Kwan spoke to the BBC.
I was recently on a conference call of 18 cities across the country who had the same situation where we had started as a political movement and a political encampment, ended up being an encampment that was no longer in control of the people who started them. And what I think you're starting to see is that the Occupy movement is looking for more stability. I spent a lot of last week talking to peaceful demonstrators, ones who wanted to separate themselves in my city away from the anarchist groups who had been looking for a confrontation with the police.
Again, that was Gene Kwan, the mayor of Oakland, California, speaking to the BBC. Josh Richman is with the Oakland, Greg Mitchell. Let me go first to Greg Mitchell. He writes the Occupy USA blog for thenation.com and his ebook, 40 Days That Shook the World, From Occupy Wall Street to Occupy Everywhere, has just been published. And Greg, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Warren. Happy to be here again.
Are you surprised to hear that the mayor of Oakland is talking with the mayors of 18 other cities around the country?
Well, I think it hasn't quite been confirmed that she meant they were closely coordinating. It sounds suspicious. A lot of people are taking it that way, that there was something set up. It is suspicious that these raids, and it's not just Portland and Oakland and New York, but also over the weekend, Salt Lake City and St. Louis and a few others, all in the last two or three days. Philadelphia has been rumored for today. It sounds awfully suspicious, and I guess we'll have to wait to see. Someone will have to ask that question, I guess.
Well, suspicious, or are they just trying to share the experience of having these occupations take place and not really knowing what to do about it?
Right. Well, that's right. It could have just been a casual information gathering or on some other subject. But, what we are seeing is sort of a buildup of many weeks of this kind of tension between the cities and the mayors and the police and these occupations. At the same time, the occupations themselves in many places, there's been more tense within them, not that they were on the verge of falling apart. In fact, most of them have kept growing and growing and growing, but they're so pro-democratic that they allow everyone to speak. They have no fixed leaders. They have a consensus decision-making process, and so it doesn't take very many people to really gum up the works. And so they're very prone to these debates and not being able to make quick decisions and so forth. So that's sort of the downside of the, one of the reasons they grow so quickly is that it is very appealing that people can join these groups and be, and become kind of leaders themselves.
What do you think of what Mayor Kwan said about the idea that the people who started the demonstrations and the camp-ins have lost control and would like to see more stability and want to difference themselves or set themselves apart from those that she called anarchists?
Well, it is true that in some cities, and so again, not all cities, these are outdoor camps. If they're in cities, larger cities, you're going to attract some homeless, you're going to attract some people with mental problems, with drug problems, and so forth. And so the camps have had difficulty with that because, on the one hand, they're trying to help these people. Part of their message is that these are people that they're for, and so they're very happy to give them a meal and maybe give them a place to stay. But, of course, over time, the numbers add up and cause other tensions. And so it's a two-sided sword. And I think that has been coming to a boiling point in some of the camps. And so it is possible that, in some places, this may force people into, force indoors for the winter. And to grow the movement in maybe slightly more traditional ways.
Greg Mitchell again, author of 40 Days That Shook the World, From Occupy Wall Street to Occupy Everywhere, and also the blogger for thenation.com on Occupy USA. We'll come back to you later in the program. First, I want to go to Josh Richman, who is a political reporter for the Oakland Tribune. And Josh Richman, thanks to you for being on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about Mayor Kwan and what's going on now in your area, not just in Oakland, which was evacuated by police last night, the night before last, then demonstrators came back yesterday. What's going on in Oakland? What's going on in Berkeley?
Well, what's going on in Oakland right now is it's preparing to go to Berkeley. There's a large group of Occupy Oakland people going to be meeting in Frank Ogawa Plaza, which had been the site of the Occupy Oakland encampment. at about midday, and they're going to march all the way up Telegraph Avenue to the Cal campus, where there is a student and faculty strike in progress today, which goes hand in hand with the return of the Occupy Cal folks who were rousted from Sproul Plaza last week. So we're expecting some interesting activity this afternoon up there.
Sproul Plaza was a very lively place during the Vietnam demonstrations. What about Mayor Kwan and her conversation with these other mayors around the country? Do you think that there is a coordinated effort taking place to do something about these protests?
I think perhaps the mayors have sort of taken some cues from the occupiers themselves, at least rhetorically speaking. Solidarity, an injury to one is an injury to all. I think there's probably some political safety in numbers that they were imagining when they had that phone call and sort of coordinating tactics. I would think it would be almost impossible if they hadn't discussed that sort of thing.
Mayor Kwan has had some problems herself, not only in deciding how to deal with the protesters, but now that she's decided to evacuate the square, she's lost a couple of her supporters. People have resigned from her office.
Well, she's lost. It's hard to see who's still supporting her at this point. The business community is very angry at her for having let the encampment go on as long as it did. We're a very progressive city here, so there's a significant percentage of the populace who's angry at her for having rousted the camp twice now.
All right. So political consequences from the left in Oakland. Josh Richmond with the Oakland Tribune. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you.
Let's go down to Josh Davis. He's a master's student at the University of North Carolina School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Covered the raid and arrests in an abandoned building in Chapel Hill on Sunday. He got cuffed and detained himself during the incident. Josh Davis, good to have you with us.
Good to be here. Thank you.
How do you relate what happened in Chapel Hill to Occupy Wall Street?
Well, in Chapel Hill, we have a community that the police and the mayor have always been pretty open to the university, and they're very open to the encampment, the Occupy Chapel Hill encampment. So it sort of caught everybody by surprise when they came in with riot police on Sunday night to evict the people who were squatting in a private building, which was sort of an offshoot of the Occupy Chapel Hill movement.
What were they doing in that building?
From everything that I understood, they were they had collected at an anarchist book fair, and they were trying to fix up the place, basically, was what I was told before the police arrived. They were trying to make it a center for, I believe, an anarchist library.
So that word anarchist comes back into the conversation. Does this suggest that there's a division between the protesters in Chapel Hill?
I think what they were looking for was more of an escalation. In North Carolina, there's adverse possession laws. So I think they saw a vacant lot that wasn't being served for the community, and they wanted to sort of repurpose that for something that fell in line a little bit more with what their political views were.
I understand there were 25 officers in riot gear who removed those people, including you.
Yeah, so what happened, and this was really out of character for what you would experience down in, you know, a college town like Chapel Hill, but they stormed in, exactly, about 25 officers with live assault weapons, pointing them at everyone, instructing myself, a News and Observer reporter, to the ground. We were handcuffed and detained for about half an hour. And, it really ties into the whole media blackout today because we really couldn't do our jobs for half an hour.
So you say the media blackout today. What do you mean?
From everything I've been reading through my Twitter streams and on Storify, there's journalists all over New York City, and not just people from other Jones in the Nation, but you're seeing NY1, NBC, Daily News, New York Post not being allowed to cover the eviction at Zuccotti Park.
Josh Davis, once again in Chapel Hill. Greg Mitchell, quickly back to you. You're in New York. Is that right? Have there been arrests of reporters there?
Yes, as I reported at my blog at The Nation just a couple hours ago, there were four
mainstream reporters arrested, including two from the AP and one from the New York Daily News. They were in a nutshell, about half of the occupied group went down to Zuccotti Park, and the other half went to another site where they thought it was safe to stay. And it turned out the police then chased them out of there, and it was at that site that these four journalists were arrested. There were a couple other freelancers arrested yesterday. There was a New York City councilman who was arrested and apparently injured. So there's been a good deal of problems with the press, but you know, I think more of what he's referring to is that there was an almost unprecedented clampdown yesterday on mainstream reporters not being allowed to get close to the what was happening in the park. They sealed the airspace over that part of New York, so you had no news copters could film from the air. And reporters in general were kind of penned off. So it was quite an unusual thing. We're seeing a real backlash today.
Okay, New York, Chapel Hill, Oakland, and Berkeley, California. Let's go now to Tulsa, Oklahoma, where Daniel Lee is a spokesperson for Occupy Tulsa. Daniel Lee, good to have you on our program.
Hi, thanks for having me, Warren.
How does the demonstration in Tulsa compare to what we've been hearing about other places around the country?
Well, we haven't seen as much aggression as they have in Portland and some of the other areas. But, we have had our share of police brutality. The city has been actively trying to keep us, they have a curfew. We have a curfew law here in city parks from 11 p.m. till 5 a.m. And they have been actively enforcing that. The first night, specifically, they came out with about 100 uniformed officers.
How many protesters?
There was about 30 of us, and 10 of us only were on the green. So 75 officers versus 10 peaceful protesters just sitting there linking arms and pepper sprayed. Was it 7 out of the 10 protesters? Who offered no resistance whatsoever. In fact, they said, I'm not going to resist arrest. I simply would like to, be taken away, but this is my constitutional right to be here.
You say there's just been about 30 people. Is that the extent of the Occupy Tulsa demonstration?
Definitely not, no. For the marches, majority of us, there are some students, but a lot of us are working adults. There's older folks and people with small children, so it's a lot easier for a lot of the other members to come out during planned marches and that sort of thing. We had a march on October 15th that at the Teamsters helped us count was about 815 people that showed up.
What are their subjects of protest? Is it clear?
Basically, we came together with the original intent of supporting in solidarity with Occupy Wall Street, protesting the corporate collusion between the corporations and government, corporate influence over politics, and also the desire that all of us have for the people's voice to actually be heard in government, grassroots democracy, and that sort of thing. But as we've grown and matured as a movement, we've also become distinctly aware of the problems that we have right here at home in Tulsa. We have one of the largest concentrations of the wealthiest elements, the 1%, here in Tulsa, as well as an extremely high percentage of people below the poverty line. So we provide a very clear picture of what's going on all over the country. For instance, over 19% of the people living here in Tulsa are below the poverty line. And there's over 1,000 homeless people in this relatively small city.
Okay. So you yourself, I understand, even though there's a curfew, you have been sleeping outside even in the rain?
That's right. We've maintained a 24/7 presence. We've been told we can be on the sidewalk, but we're not allowed to have any tents or any structures of any sort set up on the sidewalk.
Have you got waterproof clothes?
We have tarps, we try to do the best we can. And sometimes we rotate out who's out there, but we are fighting. A lot of us are fighting colds and that sort of thing, trying to keep warm. Occasionally, someone will lend us a van for a couple of nights to be able to sleep in. But I mean, this is the city of Tulsa is imposing a serious health risk on those of us that are trying to exercise our constitutional rights.
Okay, Daniel Lee, spokesperson for Occupy Tulsa, Oklahoma. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you.
Gary Gerstle is a professor of history at Vanderbilt University. He studies social movements. And, Professor, it's good to have you on our program. You've been listening for the last few minutes, and we're glad to have you. You have said, you have written, that you think that this Occupy Wall Street movement is now at a kind of crossroads.
Yes. If we think about its history over these last 59 days, I think we have to recognize that its first stage was an outstanding success. It has put before the country the issue of economic inequality in a more dramatic and vivid way than any other social movement of the last 80 years. In fact, one has to go back to the 1930s and the labor struggles of those years to find another time when so many people in America were so concerned in talking about economic inequality, the division between rich and poor, what to do about it. And there have been many groups that have tried to do that, but almost all have failed, and Occupy Wall Street is one of the first groups to break through. They now are entering what I see as a kind of second stage, and it's a vulnerable stage for them. The initial campaign has been successful, and I think they've stalled a little bit now, somewhat unsure of what to do, and some internal divisions within them between an anarchist impulse and more of a social democratic parliamentary impulse, and other divisions as well, and their habits of democracy, which are very strong, slows down their ability to move in a variety of directions. And so this is a vulnerable moment as they figure out where they're going. And it seems to me the police and the mayors in a kind of coordinated way have decided to use this moment of vulnerability to pounce in the hope that at this moment of internal division, they can succeed in evicting these people and stymieing the movement or contain it in ways in which it had not been contained before. The question is you know, releasing the police is an unpredictable move. From some of the reports I've been hearing from New York, it's like a nest of bees has been disturbed, and the bees are out there in various parts of New York. In other words, it may have counterproductive consequences from what the police and the mayors intended to do in terms of infusing new life into this movement. There have been other moments when police intervention and social protests has been deadly effective, and I think that's what the police forces and the mayors of these different cities are counting on now.
Gary Gerstle again, professor of history at Vanderbilt University, a student of social movements. Peter Wehner is former deputy assistant to the president and director of the White House Office of Strategic Initiatives. That was during the George W. Bush administration. He's now a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, and he blogs at Commentary Magazine as well. Peter Wehner, good to have you on our program.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks.
What lesson do you take from what's been happening since the beginning of the Occupy Wall Street protests? Do you think that, as Gary Gerstle said, the first stage was a success in that it put the issue of economic inequality into the headlines and into the minds of Americans for the first time in a long time?
No, not particularly. I mean, that issue was going to be there anyway, and the president was leading that debate. He's decided that that's really going to be the spearhead of his campaign in 2012. I don't think it's going to work as a political matter. Campaigning on income inequality doesn't succeed, particularly when that case is made in this manner. I happen to believe that the Occupy Wall Street movement has been a disaster for the left. I think it's going to be a boon for the Republican Party and the conservative movement. I think we're seeing the pathetic end to a pathetic and sometimes violent movement. The professor used the term habits of democracy. That's an interesting way to refer to a movement that is filled with violence and rape and arson and public defecation and public masturbation. And there seems to be a touching concern for violence as it applies to the police, but one hears very little from the left or from the people that are involved with Occupy Wall Street when you get episode after episode after episode of violence happening by the people, the protesters who are Occupy Wall Street. And one other thing I'd say is if a fraction of this had happened with a Tea Party movement, the media in this country would have gone berserk. It would have been 24/7 coverage. They searched and searched and searched to try and find some sign or some stray comment from someone that's a Tea Party movement to try and indict it. And here with Occupy Wall Street and these other movements across America, you have violence on a routine basis. And the media, much of the media and the people on the left, not only turn a blind eye to it, but celebrate it. It's disgusting. I must say there's a sort of poignancy in this, though, because the left wants so much to find a kind of Woodstock redux. There's a sort of palpable excitement on the left. They're part of a kind of revolutionary movement. So there's a sort of amusing aspect to this, as well as some things that I think are quite troubling.
All right, let me go back to Gary Gerstel on that, professor of history at Vanderbilt University. You indicated earlier that you thought this was a social movement, might have some chance of actually making social change. How do you respond to Peter Winter? Is this liable to backfire on the Democrats?
Well, it could, but let me first say that another point. I actually think the Occupy Wall Street resembles in function what the Tea Party did for the Republican Party. The Tea Party injected an enormous sense of passion, a new agenda into the Republican Party in the process of drawing that party further to the right. And Occupy Wall Street is serving a similar function for the Democratic Party in terms of invigorating a lot of passion, putting new issues on the table, being a force of popular mobilization with the potential to make a difference in American politics. And one of the issues that the Occupy Wall Street movement has to think about is a way of making their voices heard in the conventional political process, so that the kind of influence that the Tea Party has had on the Republican Party, Occupy Wall Street can begin to have on the Democratic Party.
Gary Gerstel, professor of history at Vanderbilt University, thank you very much for being with us. Peter Winter, a former deputy assistant to the president during the Bush administration, the most recent Bush administration, senior fellow now at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, blogger at Commentary Magazine. Thanks to you. Thanks to Greg Mitchell at Occupy USA, that blog for the nation, also his e-book, 40 Days That Shook the World, and our other guests as well. Well, good to have all of you on our program today, and we'll be talking about this for some time to come. That was an updated rebroadcast of today's To the Point. Which Way LA was produced tonight by Sonia Geis, Katie Cooper, and Christian Bordahl. Our technical director is Mike Newport. You can email us or share your thoughts on our comment page at kcrw.com/whichwayla. Join the conversation on Which Way LA's Facebook page. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.